I imagine now's a great time to talk about avalanches.
About snow and avalanches. Yeah, let's do it.
Also, I know nothing about avalanches, so it'll be good. So if I can understand it, then someone who's driving along and who's learning a little quick something will understand it,
too. I'll do my best here.
Sweet.
I'll put my good communication hat on, hopefully.
Yeah. So, as of right now, I've noticed that conditions are at high risk in the alpine and treeline areas.
Yes.
And there's a very weak layer of snow kind of holding up all this heavy layer of snow. And there's some terminology that gets thrown around that I like hoar frost or whatever.
Right.
I'm like, I have no idea what that means.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, there is quite a lot of terminology, and some of it is useful terminology to know, because when the weather is so tied to a snowpack, and then that creates a snowpack that has a certain structure. So we do use certain terms to describe how the snow is bonded to the mountainside. One of the terms that we do use is surface hoar. And surface hoar grows on the surface, like its name suggests, and it's a type of hoarfrost. And hoarfrost essentially grows out of the moisture that's in the air, and then it attaches itself onto the surface of the snow. And you know when the surface hoar on the surface, because the snow surface looks shimmery, and to be quite frank, it looks really pretty and really amazing. And you see these large triangular-shaped crystals, and they sometimes look sort of feathery, and they stick up a little from the snow surface. When it's on the surface, it's not a problem at all. In fact, it actually just looks really pretty. It even rides nicely if you're a skier, and if you pick some up, it's even nice to eat. You know, they're really quite beautiful things.
Mm-hmm.
The danger is when that layer becomes buried by subsequent snowfalls. So once it's been buried and the snow keeps on falling, kind of like it is now, that surface hoar layer can get buried. And when it's in that range of about 30 to 80 centimeters deep, it's particularly dangerous, because that's the magic level between having enough snow on top of it to create an avalanche that slides now potentially on that weak layer, and still be triggered by a human or by additional weight of snow that falls on top of it.
Okay.
So it's sort of setting up a structure that, you know, has this weak plane that's typically formed by something like a surface hoar layer, and then we're adding new snow to the top of that, on top of that. And then I guess we need a trigger. I guess we haven't really talked about the trigger very much.
It could be a skier, it could be a snowmobiler, or it could be maybe just a person?
Absolutely, that's right. And those are all what we call human triggers, because, you know, they're people moving around by whatever means they happen to prefer. And interestingly, there has been some science done on this, the amount of force that's applied under the snow is actually quite similar regardless of your mode of transport. So whether you're on skis, whether you're on a snowmobile, on snowshoes, the surface area, you know, is actually similar compared with the weight of, you know, that device. So, even though a snowmobile plus a person is a lot heavier than a skier, the amount of surface area is larger. So the total amount of force that's applied is somewhat similar.
Okay.
There's some nuances to that, because the track can spin and dig down a little bit in places. So, you know, there are some nuances to
that. So in one way, one may, you know, take extra precaution because I'm on a big old heavy snowmobile. But at the same time, you don't want people to think that, oh, I'm just snowshoeing. There's no way I could trigger an avalanche.
That's a great point, absolutely. Sadly, snowshoers are a group that actually we're seeing the number of incidents and the number of fatalities, unfortunately, increase in recent years. So, and I think part of that is because of the popularity and how easy it is to go to an outdoor store, buy a pair of snowshoes, strap them onto your feet, and it's really just like walking. And it is. It's a great way to get out and see and experience the mountains in Western Canada. But you do need to recognize that if you're taking yourself into avalanche terrain, you need to do just the same kind of things as a skier or a snowmobiler, who you may think of as a little bit more of an extreme type of you know, sport. But, you know, if you are going into avalanche terrain, you've got to have the right gear. It's really important to get some training, take an avalanche safety course.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's really important to check those conditions, you know what you're going into before you go.
Of course. Now, I went snowshoeing up Ripple Ridge not that long ago, had a total fun time. And, of course, there were a few shortcuts we took, which brings me to my next question. What does avalanche terrain look like? Because for some, it could simply mean I veered off the path slightly, or it could be the path itself, or a full-blown, giant, windswept, like, you know, lattice of ice over a cliff, you know? Some, I would imagine, look a little bit more obvious than others.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, to be honest, it is something that you grow in experience with some miles in the mountains. And certainly when you go out with more experienced people, they can point out things. Maybe they're even familiar with a time when an avalanche occurred in a certain area. And sometimes, like you said, they're quite obvious. Mountainsides typically, you know, once they're steep enough, so that's over about 30 degrees, will often have swaths down them where the trees have been cleared for some reason. Often they're sort of consistent with gullies, little features where the snow tends to get funneled, or they're sort of more steeper, planar sort of slopes high up. And you'll notice that an absence of trees. That kind of thing is, you know, a more classic and a more obvious avalanche path. And if you're standing in one or underneath one, then, you know, you have a lot of clues that you're in avalanche terrain.
That makes sense. I mean, yeah, it clearly it's a big, beautiful white slide.
That's right.
And things could slide down that slide.
Yeah.
Including the slide itself, which would be horrifying.
That's right, yeah. And maybe I can give you an example of an area that could be a little trickier. And, you know, once you get up to, I don't know, around sort of 1,700 meters in our part of the world, the trees start to thin out a little bit, and you get these little openings in the trees, and maybe you're on a slope and you've got like a tennis court-sized opening, but the trees, maybe they're not really touching each other, they're just the little small guys that tend to grow in the sort of subalpine areas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of picture, if you can sort of picture that, some few scrubby trees and, you know, sort of a little bit of a wide open place, if that's steep enough, again, you know, over 30 degrees, especially if it's got some kind of rollover type shape to it, that, again, is going to be a prime place that an avalanche could happen. It's not going to be a huge avalanche, most likely, but if it's a tennis court sized or larger, then it would potentially have enough size to bury and potentially injure, or, you know, if you got unlucky, bury and kill a person. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's the size of terrain that you're looking at that's sort of relatively open. And that's often the kind of terrain that catches people out a little bit.
How much snow does it take to really bury someone to the point where they are completely trapped? I mean, I always imagine the, you know, robot arm from Terminator just busting out and being like, aha, you almost got me, but you didn't. But we're not Terminators, we're human beings. So I imagine it doesn't really take that much to make us incapacitated.
No, you're absolutely right. And snow has this amazing ability, once it's in motion and it then flows around things, as soon as it stops, it really sets up and it's like concrete. And this is really consistent with people who've been buried in an avalanche. You have this preconceived idea that you'd be able to bust yourself out quite easily, but when it actually happens, people find it just, they can't move a limb once they're completely encircled by snow. So, you know, the truth is, if your head is buried in the snow and you're unable to move your arms and your legs, then that's a critical situation. And you know, then we're in a rescue situation. So now we're, you know, sort of the conversation needs to move on how best to extract and get that person out of the snow, because you know, the chances are you're not going to be able to get yourself out. I mean, it does happen occasionally, And we do hear stories of people having an arm free or something and being able to dig themselves out. But your best bet in that situation is to have a companion there and have that companion have the right equipment and the right training to be able to get you out of the snow under that situation.
Okay. Well, speaking of the right equipment, and I'm perfectly aware that the equipment is only as good as the person who's trained to use it. What kind of equipment do people use to help themselves in those kind of situations?
Yeah, so what we call the avalanche essentials are three pieces of equipment, and they go together. And everyone in the team needs to have all of these. And it's an avalanche transceiver, a probe, and a shovel. And they work like this. The avalanche transceiver, you wear it on your person, and you switch it on in the morning, and don't worry about batteries until you switch it off at night. The batteries last about 30 days, so you've got plenty of juice there, I guess. They're designed to live for a long time, mm-hmm. or last a long time. And that sends a signal once every second into the airwaves, and it has around about a 50-meter radius, give or take a little bit.
Wow.
And if that person is buried under the snow, then another member of the group needs to then turn their transceiver into search mode. In fact, all the other members of the group need to do that. Otherwise, you end up finding members of the group who are just moving around on the surface. But all of the other group members need to turn their transceiver to search, and then that permits them to find that person who is buried under the snow.
Does it kind of do one of those things? And I'm going to bring up Tinder back in the day. You could find out how far away someone is from you. Very
right.
Creepy stuff.
Yeah.
But if you had three accounts, you could triangulate where someone was.
Right.
So you could technically stalk someone on Tinder. I didn't do this. But it sounds like you could do the very same thing, but to find someone buried in an avalanche.
Yes, and the modern devices are really good, and it's interesting you mentioned that number three, because the modern transceivers have three antennas, and that essentially allows you to do exactly what you're talking about.
Oh, hooray.
You get both a direction and a distance, and so with that direction, you follow, essentially an arrow on the device, and then you can watch the numbers get smaller and smaller again on the screen of your device, and most of them have some kind of audio signal as well, which gets progressively
like a ping.
More intense. Yes, exactly. That's right.
Mm, okay, so you could in theory just have one partner with you.
Yeah.
Find you.
That's right.
Okay.
Absolutely.
But if you have more people, obviously, the better.
Yes, and as we get into more advanced techniques, if there's one person buried and you have, say, three people searching, then you would probably direct one person to be the lead on the search using the transceiver, and then other people would be getting other things ready, which is that probe and the shovel. And the probe is what's going to do your final pinpointing. And with the transceiver, you'll typically get within a meter, maybe two, of the victim. And then the probe you use to make that physical connection with the person.
Yeah.
And so that's the sort of next piece of that.
I've always had a fear that I'd be not just buried in an avalanche, but I'd get a probe in the eyeball.
Hit in the eye. It's a common concern. The simple reply is it's probably the best poke in the eye that you'll ever have.
I bet.
That happens to you.
Ow, yes.
Yep.
Oh, thank God.
Yes. I think the truth is I've never actually heard of anyone being poked in the eye. So
that's good.
The chances are much greater that you'd hit a fleshy piece of thigh or back or something like that.
Fleshy thigh. That's
yes.
That's perfect. Okay.
You
so you've probed someone, and now you got to bury them out or dig them out.
That's right. Yes, and shoveling is actually really important. It's one of those things. Of course, we all think we can do really well because we shovel in our gardens and other places.
Yeah, but this is that snowy concrete you mentioned.
Yes, that's right. There are some techniques. Again, it's one of the subjects actually in avalanche training course is how best to shovel out and dig out a person. If they're shallow, it's fairly simple. You just go for it. As soon as they're a meter or more under the snow, then you essentially, you sort of think about tunneling from the side, essentially. You know, you don't want to dig a shaft, you know, like a sort of, you know, a mine shaft that goes straight down, because all the snow starts to fall back in, and you have a real hard time picking a person out of a hole like that. But if you sort of tunnel in from the side, then it's a lot easier to move the snow out of the way, and then, of course, deal with the buried victim once you find them.
So you're building a shaft next to the human vein that you're trying to extract.
Yes, exactly.
Lovely.
Yep.
And all the while, this person is hopefully breathing, because you mentioned, you know, that snow finding a way around people, and if you're trapped, I imagine your oxygen supply would run out pretty soon.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, this is such a great point. People who are found within the first 10 minutes actually stand a very good chance of survival. The survival rate is 80%, and that includes, you know, the instances of people hitting objects and things
Wow.
like that. So, you know, the survival rate in the first 10 minutes is excellent. Once you go beyond that, then the mortality rate drops off quite rapidly. And so that has a few implications. I mean, firstly, you know, our discussions about good shoveling techniques actually matters, because the difference between digging somebody out in a couple of minutes versus, you know, 8 or 9 minutes or something like that is huge.
Mm-hmm. Especially if it takes you, you know, quite a while to find them in the first place.
That's right, yeah. Practicing with, you know, your equipment is vital. But then there's also a comment about how big a slope you were on in the first place. And if you are on a really big slope with a really big avalanche, then the chances are your fellow companions will need to travel quite a way to actually find you, and that's going to take some time. You might be buried deeper under the snow, and so that's going to prolong the amount of time that it takes to get that person out. And if you're more than that 50 meters away, then, again, you're going to have to do some additional techniques to even find that signal in the first place. So all of these increase the length of time that you could potentially be buried. So, you know, the trick here is, you know, small slopes do make a lot of sense, especially as avalanche conditions deteriorate. So, you know, especially in the kind of conditions we're in right now, quite frankly, if you make a habit of sticking just to small slopes, and, you know, maybe that just, you know, a little bit of open terrain for a little while, and then you have a chance to sort of deep back into a forest if you're on skis, you know, or if you're not confident with all of this, if, you know, all of this is giving you sort of hairs on your back standing up, you know, fully stay in the trees if you're a snowshoer, maybe, or if you're riding a sled, stick to the open meadows that are sort of further away from avalanche terrain, and wait until the avalanche conditions improve a little bit before hitting those slopes or climbing up the ridges to get a little bit higher.
Yeah, well, what I'm kind of gathering from this is, if there's snow above you and there's no trees and it's on a slope, there is a good chance that snow can find its way on top of you.
Yes, I think that's a pretty good way of looking at it, yeah.
That's good. Okay. Now, any last... here's one. I was just curious about people that maybe want to get some training. I know Avalanche Canada is a great resource to get people the training they need, but what are some of the first steps people can go through? And I'm actually just asking personally, because I would love to take these courses myself. What are some of the first steps you should take to maybe get into an avalanche course? Because I imagine the first one is you should have some other training beforehand.
Yeah, well, I mean, so the Avalanche Canada training program has a number of courses that are sort of very accessible. The one that most people take is the AST1. That's the Avalanche Skills Training Level 1. It's a 2-day course. Most people find that it's just a lot of fun. You're outside. There is a classroom session, but you also go outside into the mountains. You're with people who you know, are looking for the same kind of opportunities in the mountains as you most likely are. And so there's a real good chance to meet new people and bond over some shared experiences in the mountains. The AST1 course is designed to give you the foundation of recognizing avalanche terrain, some of the things we were talking about just now, learning about companion rescue and the right gear, and then learning about some steps you can take to match appropriate terrain with the current conditions.
Okay.
So you know, that's certainly the place to start. There's an AST level 2, which is more of a 4-day course where you would be expected to have the level 1 coming into that. And it's just it's a great course. It gives you a lot more chance to actually make decisions and experience a range of different conditions and, actually go through the whole process yourself. We also have a companion rescue course where you can just hone in on those companion rescue skills if you feel as though that's the sort of weak link that you have. And there's a managing avalanche terrain course, which conversely is more focused on simply looking at a range of terrain, talking about how you might manage and move through that area, again, under different conditions in a safe manner.
Where are you based out of?
Revelstoke.
Revelstoke, right? Yep. On. Yeah,
not
I love Revelstoke.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fantastic mountain. Also has to deal with a lot of blasting, I imagine.
Yes, that's right. We've been hearing the booms in town quite a lot, which is a good cue that there's avalanche danger out there.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for calling in. Very informative. Obviously, I'll edit out all the parts that are just kind of sloppy.
I appreciate that.
But I really enjoyed this, so I might even send out the edited but somewhat full version on my website, and just so people can get the whole rundown.
Perfect.
And it will also just be a quick news story, so I really appreciate your help.
Great. Thanks very much, Jensen.
All right. Have a great day.
Okay. And you. Bye now.